second case first, Patel versus Phillip. Mr. Burton.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Justin Burton, and I'm here on behalf of Dhamrambhai Patel in his petition for review of the consolidated cases on his motions to reopen. There seems to be some confusion as to the standard of review in this case. The government seems to argue that there is a standard of abuse of discretion that must be looked at to overturn the decision by the Board of Immigration Appeals. However, this Court has in many cases indicated that this would require de novo review, as it implicates due process in the service of notice to appears and notices of hearing. In this case, there's a two-step analysis that must be done to determine whether a case should be reopened. The first step in the analysis is the sufficiency of service, as guided by 1229A(b)(5), which requires that the government serve the notice to appear to the last known address and must establish by clear, convincing, and unequivocal evidence that this is done. In this case, the notice to appear, well, there seem to be problems with the notice to appear, and it was reset on several occasions. The notice to appear was ultimately sent to 4 Wedgwood Place in Miller Place, Long Island City. The problem is Miller Place and Long Island City are 68.2 miles apart from one another. And it wasn't the last known address provided to the government on behalf of Dhamrambhai Patel. It appears that Dhamrambhai had sent a letter asking for clarification because he couldn't read a receipt that the asylum office provided him. And on that envelope, he used 4 Wedgwood Place, Miller Place, 4 Wedgwood Lane, Miller Place, New York. And he never wrote Long Island City. Apparently, he did receive that receipt, but he never received anything thereafter. And since the proper address was not used, the correct address was not used, the government cannot show by clear, convincing, and unequivocal evidence that it was sent to the proper address. Therefore, it doesn't even pass the first step, and the case, therefore, must be reopened. The second step in the analysis would be to determine whether he actually received notice. And this was governed by Joshi, which this court heard, as well as matter of GYR. And the alien must actually receive the NTA. Service to the last known address is not enough. And that's governed by 8 U.S.C. 1229 A1F, which gives written and statutory requirements that must be met in order for a last known address or an address to be used for purposes of service. In this case, it appears that a name Patel was written on a certified mailing sent back to the government. However, it doesn't determine whether this person is a person above age and a requirement to accept service of process. And also, it doesn't appear that it is even Mr. Patel. The record establishes that Mr. Patel did not live at that address at that time. It also has evidence in the record from the owner of the address where he rented that nobody lived at that residence, that it remained vacant, that it was being remodeled at the time the service was attempted to be made. The problem is we don't know who this Patel was that signed it. There were issues related to ineffective assistance to counsels and contradictory affidavits. There was a matter of Lozada where an alien can claim ineffective assistance in counsel, and this was done because there were certain efforts by previous counsel made which muddled the record. And to clarify the record, we needed to show that Dhamrambhai had nothing to do with either providing a fraudulent envelope or allegedly fraudulent envelope to the government, and that he had difficulties
in it. Is there any doubt that it's fraudulent?
From my understanding, it was questionable, and I think the...
What was questionable about it?
There was a meter stamp placed on the envelope, and it was used to show that Dhamrambhai...
But the meter was not in existence at the time.
And that's right. And I don't...
Well, that makes it fraudulent, doesn't it?
Well, I don't want to cast allegations. I don't think it's...
He already did. You said allegation.
Maybe I just wanted to, I didn't want to disparage anybody's name.
Why did sugarcoat it a little bit?
I just didn't want to disparage somebody's name. But yes, it is, my understanding, it looks fraudulent. And especially when you backdate a meter stamp.
You can say it. It doesn't hurt.
Okay. The bottom line is my client had nothing to do with it. The Muradabai had no knowledge of this metered stamp. Ultimately, it was the previous counsel or his office that had prepared that motion, prepared an affidavit.
Didn't your client sign an affidavit saying he had used that envelope in mailing a change of address?
You know what? I'm not sure. He signed an affidavit. I'm not sure if it's specifically stated that he used an envelope to change his address. He indicated he changed his address, but not necessarily whether he changed the envelope. The problem is the Muradabai doesn't speak English very well at all, and he was detained at the time. The attorney never went out to see him while he was in custody. So what ends up happening is you get this affidavit sent to you, what the Muradabai did, while he's sitting in custody. He has nobody to translate the affidavit for him, so he signs it, and he sends it back to the attorney off of the advice of the attorney, just sign it and send it back to me, without fully knowing what the affidavit says. I think that's part of the ineffective assistance claim. The Muradabai was doing things, they didn't know what was going on, and his attorney was filing motions and affidavits and preparing evidence that was clearly fraudulent. The Muradabai was detained. He had no access to his attorney by just simply calling him, and it made it very difficult. I'd like to reserve at this point. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Sheehan?
May it please the Court, Dan Shea on behalf of the United States Government. This is a consolidated appeal of two motions to remove, to reopen an in absentia order of removal. The issue in this case is pretty straightforward. It's simply a fact-specific case, and that is whether the record compels the conclusion that the petitioner met his burden of demonstrating non-receipt of his removal hearing notice 6 years after the in absentia order of removal was entered. But because the record does not compel such a conclusion, this petition for review must be denied. This petition for review should be denied first because the first motion was clearly precluded because he had submitted fraudulent evidence, and that was the only evidence that he had submitted, which he now concedes was, in fact, fraudulent. And a second motion to reopen should be denied for two independent reasons. First, it is well settled that a motion to reopen shall not be granted unless it appears to the board that the evidence sought to be offered is material and was not available and could not have been discovered or presented at the former hearing. In the present case, none of the evidence the petitioner submitted in support of his second motion to reopen was new or could not have been previously submitted at his former hearing. Indeed, here in his opening brief, he doesn't proffer any reason why this evidence was unavailable before. He doesn't explain why he couldn't have raised an ineffective assistance of counsel claim in his direct appeal to the BIA, since at that time he was already represented by his present attorney. Nor does he explain why the affidavit from the landlord or evidence of the defective address were not available until now, let alone explain how these reasons would compel any reasonable fact finder to conclude that this was in fact new evidence. Second, and in the alternative, even assuming the evidence was in fact new, the petitioner did not meet his burden of proof in showing non-receipt. INA 240B5C allows rescission of an in absentia removal order if the alien demonstrates that he did not receive notice of the removal hearings. It is unclear whether the petitioner's counsel obtains the standard review that the government bears the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence that the petitioner did not receive notice. The burden actually remains upon the petitioner to prove non-receipt.
Mr. Shea, if I'm correct, you haven't argued yet that we have no jurisdiction over the appeal on the basis of our decision in Kukana and Huang. Are those cases applicable?
You know, I'm not familiar with those cases, but I don't think that jurisdiction is at issue here. But in any event, the facts in this case clearly do not support reopening. The evidence that he submits, even assuming that the evidence was new and could be considered by this court, none of it compels the conclusion that the petitioner did not receive notice. Here, substantial evidence supports the BIA's rejection of the affidavit from the alleged landlord of the property. He submits no evidence that the property was in fact owned by this man, nor does he submit any evidence to show mitigate the contradiction between the fact that his The affidavit itself states that the property was vacant between September of 97 through September of 2000, but then he himself claims in both his first motion to reopen and his first affidavit that he remained at the New York address until December 31st of 1998. And now he says that those affidavits were invalid, but in the second affidavit that he submits to present counsel, he again states that he was at the address until 1998 and that his friend had actually remained there and that he relied on his friend to forward the evidence, to forward the notices to him. In fact, in his second affidavit that he submitted in support of his second motion to reopen, there's absolutely no evidence that he states anywhere that he filed a change of address form. Secondly, Your Honors, the record also shows that the address, in fact, does exist, evidenced by the fact that mail was sent there through certified mail and that it was signed by somebody. He claims now that it's not him, of the last names match up, and the address has been, the mail has been sent there.
Isn't Patel kind of a common name?
It may be, but it...
So is Bauer.
Right. But in his first motion to reopen again, there was no affidavit to support that claim. And in fact, in the second affidavit, he never states what the correct address is. So all the evidence that he proffers to his counsel, that is not evidence before this court. So he says the address is wrong, but there's no evidence supporting that it was what the correct address was. Third, none of the cases that the petitioner cites are actually applicable to the present case. In Sabir, that case, it was undisputed that receipt was not that the notice was not received by the petitioner. In this case, it's clearly disputed by the government that notice was not received. In Joshi, the case was remanded to the BIA because the BIA wrongfully concluded that an affidavit is not evidence. And in this case, there's been no such erroneous finding. In fact, the facts here are far more analogous to those found in Murtuza, where this court upheld the IJ's determination that after weighing all the evidence and concluding that the petitioner failed to meet his burden of proof, that substantial evidence did in fact support this determination. So, in short, Your Honors, if Your Honors have no further questions, no reasonable fact finder would be compelled to conclude that the petitioner established non-receipt of his removal hearing notices. Therefore, this petition should be denied.
Thank you. Burton? Much time.
Thank you, judges. Apparently, there seems to be some confusion about what an attorney can add in a direct appeal. When you directly appeal a case from the immigration court, you can't include outside facts in the appeal. We had no other choice but to file a separate motion to reopen with the Board of Immigration Appeals to bring in additional facts to be able to have the board consider that. On direct appeal, all we have is the record that was created by previous counsel or by ourselves when we argued it before the immigration judges. There was also mention of Patel being a common name. Certain neighborhoods, including neighborhoods here in Chicago, Patels seem to congregate, and yes, it's a very, very common Indian name. And in immigrant communities, you're going to find, in Indian immigrant communities, you're going to find clusters of Patel families around. It doesn't mean that it's a responsible person at the home. It doesn't mean that it was properly delivered. The burden remains on the government to show, by clear and convincing evidence, unlike what counsel indicated, that it was served at the last known address, and the last known address has to be accurate. We do know the last known address. He indicates it in his affidavits. There was a letter written to the asylum office, which includes the last known address. I do not know where the government got the Long Island City address. They seem to indicate that he was released out on bond or released from custody in page 158 of the record. He was never in custody back in 2000, so I'm not sure where that came from or where it was manufactured. All I know is it wasn't issued properly to Damrotabai, and Damrotabai did not provide that Long Island City address. With regards to questions about jurisdiction, and especially the Wang cases, and whether we have jurisdictions and motions to reopen before this court, in this type of motion to reopen case, we do. It is not a discretionary decision to reopen a case where there's an in absentia order and improper service. Improper service is a question of law and fact. There's no discretion issued by the immigration judge.
But your real question, your real problem with what happened in this case was whether or not he received notice, right?
Yes.
Actual notice. That's a fact question.
There's two questions. Whether the notice was sufficient, the first step, and second, whether he actually received notice. Both of them factual-related questions. Both of them questions of law, too. There is no discretionary.
That would make any application of facts to a constitutional principle a question of law. Is that right?
Perhaps you can bootstrap it, but in weighing, the motion to reopen was based on an asylum and additional evidence to pursue asylum, and the ultimate decision on a motion to reopen and weighing or any of the asylum cases is a discretionary decision. Discretionary decision is whether he can show that he would be subject to persecution and whether he deserves to have the case reopened. That's in an asylum context or in a motion to reopen context after a final decision. This is not a final decision. This is a question of service and proper service.
I'm not sure that I understand the distinction you made between, said there were two questions.
Mm-hmm.
What are the two questions?
The first question is whether it was sufficient service under 1229AB5. Whether the government showed by clear, convincing, and unequivocal evidence that this was sent to the last known address.
Clearly a fact question.
Right. The second question is Joshi, which says, did he actually receive notice? And so that would be the second question. Both of them are non-discretionary decisions. They're decisions of fact and law, and that's it. That provides jurisdiction to this court.
What, in your view, then, is the proper province of Hoang and Kukan?
It only pertains to motions to reopen where there's a discretionary component in granting the motion to reopen. And clearly this court does not have it because it's statutory where there is a discretionary decision. This court is divested of jurisdiction, and that's written into the statute.
So you think we do have jurisdiction then over the application of fact to constitutional principles?
Not in general. If, for instance, I bring up a case on an application for cancellation or removal, or ultimately a discretionary decision on asylum, or a discretionary decision on a 212C application, there might be an ultimate question of fact, but the problem is we can't get jurisdiction because the ultimate decision was a discretionary decision that can be granted by the Immigration Court or the Board.
So it's when the ultimate decision is a matter of discretion.
That's when
think that Kukana Hawaiian apply. Is that correct?
Correct.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Thank you, Judge.
All right. Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement, and we'll move.